Good morning and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sex. I have to admit, I cannot get this song out of my head today. It feels like the land of confusion to me. Let's start here. We've crossed the threshold of 84,000 Americans who died of the novel coronavirus. This morning we learned that nearly 3 million more Americans filed for unemployment insurance. So the 8-week total is 36.5 million Americans unemployed. It's pretty obvious, by the way, that Dr. Anthony Fauci is done. I actually said this in my newsletter. I mean, he's not formally done, but you can see what's happening here. The Fox News hosts are trashing him. The GOP is bailing on him. Trump is criticizing him in public. And Rush Limbaugh was asked, well, why doesn't Trump just fire Anthony Fauci? And Limbaugh said, no, what he should do is he should praise Fauci and then just simply ignore everything he's saying. Just simply ignore him, which I think is pretty much where we're at. And meanwhile, we're also in the midst of this genuinely bizarre cultural debate over whether you should wear masks or not wear masks. It has become now the ultimate tribal red-blue signal. And meanwhile, there's a real question about whether anti-vaxxers are going to effectively sabotage any coronavirus vaccine that we have. I tweeted out a quote from a columnist, I think it was in the New York Times, who said, what happens if half of Americans refuse to take the vaccine? My state of Wisconsin is really kind of thrown into, we'll talk about this in a moment, into a state of confusion when the state Supreme Court threw out the governor's extension of the stay-at-home order, but did not stay the order. The legislature brought the lawsuit and expected that the court would issue an injunction, because it's a conservative court, would issue an injunction, but then stay the order so that they could work out some sort of a rational, reasonable compromise. They didn't. The order went into effect immediately. Bars around the state open, and you're getting these scenes of people partying shoulder to shoulder, no social distancing, and of course, no mask. Nobody knows what the state of the law is. Meanwhile, the president is on Fox Business with Maria Bartiromo, who assures the president that Obamagate, I actually wrote this quote down, that Obamagate is the biggest political scandal we've ever seen. Obamagate is the biggest political scandal we've ever seen. I try not to use words like nothing burger a lot, but the gap between the hype and hysteria and the actual substance here is truly extraordinary. Meanwhile, we have a United States senator who gets a subpoena. The FBI shows up at Senator Burr's house to give him a subpoena about this insider training, and apparently takes his phone away from him. That is not usual. And we are seeing the General Flynn case play out in, shall we say, highly unusual manner. And you've probably already forgotten about this, but 2 days ago, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case of Trump versus Vance, which is arguably the most important separation of powers case that we have had in decades. So to sort out all of this confusion, we're lucky to have Bulwark contributor, constitutional scholar, Kim Whaley. Kim, good morning.
Good morning, Charlie. I thanks for that Phil Collins little clip. I want to highlight another part of that, which is there's not enough love to go around these days.
There's not enough love to go around, and there is the confusion. Do you remember, by the way, the music video of that? Because I'm going to get ripped for this.
I don't know. I'm trying to find it in my brain, because I'm sure I watched it many times on MTV.
Yes, and it was funky, but it was an anti-Reagan video. And you know, it shows Reagan and Nancy in bed with the ape and all this stuff, and Henry Kissinger, and so it's a. I get that, people. but still sometimes we need to have the art rise above the politics of the day, and we are in the land of confusion. So where should we start today? Kim, you have a piece in the Bulwark about Michael Flynn. I want to get to the unmasking thing because that I'm kind of obsessed with that. Trying to raise my hand in the midst of the hysteria and say, guys, you understand that there's no law broken here. This is routine. But, you know, so let's just talk about the Michael Flynn case.
Yeah.
You point out that Michael Flynn just cannot walk away from his guilty plea. Why not? Why not let this thing go? The Department of Justice says, our bad, we screwed up, they've withdrawn the charges. He's saying, I no longer want to plead guilty. The judge isn't letting him go.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the Judge Sullivan, Emmett Sullivan, the district court in D.C. has been sort of a master at sort of figuring out how to retain the integrity of the Justice Department and the U.S. court system in this process, because he's essentially said, listen, you can't have it both ways. Either you lied to the FBI or you lied to me when you pleaded guilty. And you know, we have to keep in mind this. The guilty plea is like a conviction. I mean, it's almost like we already have a jury verdict. The ball is in the court, in the court's court, to decide on a sentencing. The DOJ is kind of really out of it in a way. They did make this motion. The rules require the judge to authorize it. And what the judge said was, listen, I've got, you know, a thumb on one side of the scale here. I've got the Justice Department and Michael Flynn arguing for dismissal. I need to hear from the other side. So not only did he invite what are called amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs, to sort of give the reason why in the public interest letting this guy walk is not a good idea, but also appointed a retired judge to make that argument. So he's going to hear both sides. And that retired judge was asked to look into potential perjury in open court when Michael Flynn lied allegedly about his lie. Who knows what part of the lie it is, but he's essentially saying, Judge Sullivan, you lied somewhere, and I'm not going to just let this one go.
Okay. Is there any precedent for that? Has anyone ever been charged with perjury because of what they said in a guilty plea?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I'd have to do a little research. But of course, the Judge Sullivan himself can't go around charging people with perjury. It would have to be the Justice Department. So it's a bit of a, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to understand what the end game is here for the judge, because of course, if he it's a lose-lose for him. I mean, if he goes forward and sentences him, there's going to be massive uproar about a biased, politically motivated judge. But if he lets him walk, I mean, listen, the Justice Department's theory for dismissing this case is essentially that the 2016 investigation into Russian interference was itself bogus.
Right.
And of course, that just is gaslighting beyond comprehension. And I think the judge just knows this and doesn't want to be caught into the political fray here.
Okay, so speaking of gaslighting here, the whole unmasking, and you can tell the Trump world is all in on this. I mean, this is a full court press. Fox News has become an absolute alternative reality. This is the biggest scandal in the world. Basically, what it is, Chuck Grassley, Ron Johnson posted yesterday this list of people who you may or may not have, who may have unmasked Michael Flynn's identity in the transcripts of the conversations that he had last December with the Russian ambassador. And the president is saying, this is terrible. We caught them. People should go to jail. I actually tweeted out this morning. So is this arrest Obama? Is this going to become a thing in Trump world? I just don't know. I want to get your take on this, because I'm genuinely trying to figure out what law they're alleged to have been violated. I mean, it sounds like if they did this, and it seems like at least some of this happened, they did it by the book. They had approval from the NSA. And even if they unmasked Flynn's identity, you know, we don't know that Joe Biden read it or anything. But the argument, Nicholas Grossman said, the argument here is that somehow it was totally unfair that the sitting administration's top foreign policy, national security, and law enforcement officials found out who was conducting secret conversations with Russia's ambassador about undermining the administration's foreign policy. They're obviously monitoring the ambassador. They know that he's involved with Russian intelligence. They catch him talking to an American about undermining U.S. foreign policy. And I guess we're supposed to believe now that they have to willfully ignore it. Otherwise, it's the biggest scandal in the history of America.
Yeah, I think the word unmasking, even though it's, I think, your word used inside the government, is unfortunate here because it suggests that there's some wrongdoing. But this is all of a piece with the Flynn situation. I mean, Bill Barr wrote a letter, and you know, before he became attorney general, to the president, trashing the Mueller investigation and calling Michael Flynn a good guy. And then since then, you know, he's been trotting around the globe and doing other things in public, basically to try to you know, reverse the narrative that now we have a bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee confirming, again, in I think volume three of its five-volume report, or volume four, the Russians interfered in the 2016 election, right, to help President Trump. And it's a stunning Alice in Wonderland moment where, yes, we have, you know, the Trump team literally trying to blink reality, trying to reverse facts in a way that's really troubling. And it doesn't seem to matter, as you indicate, that there was nothing wrong done here. In fact, these people did the right thing. I really don't want that kind of stuff going on in government and not having it people held accountable for it.
No, I think you put this extremely well. And I hope people underline the way you just articulated that. In order for you to think that this is just an out of the blue scandal, you have to forget that, in fact, the Russians were interfering in our election, that we had just gone through a presidential election that was under attack by the Russians. They're, you know, outside of, you know, hardcore Trump world, the intelligence agencies have been unanimous on this, that there was this Russian effort. So why would, you know, the Obama administration be concerned with these kinds of communications? And by the way, these unmaskings are extremely routine. My understanding is that there have been tens of thousands of this, with, you know, that essentially it's a legal wiretap. It's a legal, you know, monitoring. An American person is engaged in it. They're sort of caught up in it. And the intelligence agencies, well, we want to know who it was. So, but, and again, there's a procedure, there's a law, the law was followed. But again, you
The unmasking really, Charlie, is making all of this public in this point and, well, you know, putting these people's heads on a stick. I mean, it's the investigators aren't the criminals here. I mean, Michael Flynn pleaded guilty to a federal crime and he's now the victim, and the people that were doing their jobs, you know, career public servants that go to work every day to keep America safe, are now being cast aside and attacked as the wrongdoers here, as the criminals, yeah, here. This is the biggest scandal. It's deeply, deeply, deeply disturbing for the future of American democracy. And I know people don't like to hear that, but it's hanging on by a thread right now. And every day we get darker and darker and darker.
Well, this is also consistent with the Trump effort to discredit law enforcement, to discredit any investigations of him, to discredit the Mueller investigation. I mean, this gives him a twofer, you know, the Mueller investigation, you know, lying Jim Comey, he can do all of that. But also, I think we need to just understand the political context of this. In order to understand, I think, Donald Trump, the Trump political mindset, you have to understand the concept of projection, that you have to accuse the other guy of what you are doing. I mean, part of the irony, of course, is that Trump himself claims that the president of the United States under Article 2 can do anything, right? Isn't Trump and Barr been arguing that the president can order anyone to be investigated or drop any criminal investigation, can do anything they want? But what they're doing is they're taking some of the things that they have done and projecting it onto the other side. So if you're accused of corruption and nepotism and venality and being running a kleptocracy, you talk about Hunter Biden. If you've been caught lying thousands and thousands of times, you accuse your critics of fake news. If you have been misusing the power and levers of government, you create this fictitious Obamagate. And this is his playbook, isn't it?
Right, right. I mean, this is the Roy Cohn playbook too, right? Go attack all of the critics. This is also a part of the playbook for people that want to turn democracies historically into autocracies, is to just attack any critic. And that to the point where it becomes that Trump's truth is the truth. That, of course, then we're no longer in a functioning democracy. And again, I love, we're back into throwback mode today with Phil Collins, but everyone should go back and look at the 1944 film with Ingrid Bergman called Gaslight, where her husband is convincing her she's going going insane while he's poisoning her. That we are in this moment where we have to, you know, remind ourselves that water is wet and the sky is blue, because the assault on truth is really, we have to hang on to our seats and hold on to our truths.
Well, and it's only May. So you have to wonder how bad is this going to get? We're already seeing these conspiracy theories being pushed. I don't even think we can get into the fact that it sounds like the Trump administration is embracing a lot of conspiracy theories, including that the coronavirus death toll is too high. And, you know, good Lord about that. I mean, by October, Donald Trump may be, you know, flat out pure QAnon. But one of the interesting questions is why he is ramping it up to this level, you know, going after Obama, you know, talking about this worst scandal ever, the extra strength conspiracy theories. And in my newsletter, I quote Jack Schaefer from Politico, who has a theory. He said, "My intuition tells me that both his supporters and critics have grown numb to his previous rhetorical excesses and the need for him to cross new boundaries, violate new taboos, and break fresh panes of glass in order to remain engaged." It's sort of like either drug use or pornography. It has to become more intense that you become numb, so you constantly have to raise it. But you do wonder, how long can you keep that up before people are going, okay, I've lost the narrative. I think David Frum was right. Do people actually understand what the hell he's talking about here?
I don't know. I mean, I think another explanation could be much more simple, which is 84,000 people dead. I know. I mean,
36 million Americans unemployed.
Yeah, I hate to use the new coining blank gate, because I think I don't want to give credence to that theory. On the other hand, now there's a new bad guy, and we can carry the torch to go in that direction and ignore the fact that the economy and human life are really, really in bad shape, and it's not going to change. As you mentioned, Dr. Fauci is now on the out. So we really don't have any leadership. We don't have a plan. And people are going to continue to die and be hungry and be jobless. But now we can all focus on this fake narrative that the actual investigation and decision by intelligence officials, Robert Mueller's Republicans and Democrats, that Putin interfered in 2016. That was all actually a big conspiracy to take down Donald Trump, even though it is a fact. I mean, it's mind blowing. It's mind blowing, which is an overused term.
on the pandemic and where we're at right now with the 84,000 Americans. Apparently, the president this morning is now, you know, has once again moved the goalposts and said it'll be over 100,000, which seems now inevitable. And he said that's at the low end of the range. You know, we've talked about this numerous times on the podcast, but it is really extraordinary the way that there is this bizarre cultural war over the masks. And we have a great piece in the Bulwark today by JVL, the curious case of people who want to reopen America but not wear masks. And he's got these Venn diagrams that it's kind of odd. The don't wear masks movement overlaps almost entirely with the reopen immediately movement, which is so weird, because the best way, and I know I'm repeating myself, the best way to reopen and make people feel better is to look around and think, hey, my fellow citizens are taking this seriously. But if you look at the scenes from my home state of Wisconsin, you know, in Platteville, the people showing up at the bar to, you know, celebrate this new Supreme Court ruling, and, you know, there's no social distancing, there's no masks. And the mask thing has become, I mean, the mask has become kind of like the red Make America Great hat. That if you are conservative, you cannot wear that mask. And it's like, wow, talk about a dangerous situation, and one that seems to be incredibly counterproductive if you really want people to go back to something approaching normal life.
Yeah, I read JVL's piece, and I thought it was an excellent point that he made, that it's the same people that want to reopen the economy and don't want to be under these stay-at-home orders that are also at the same time refusing to wear masks. But I think it's not just a land of confusion, but it's a land of checking common sense at the door. We keep going back to 1 + 1 = 2, and that basic equation is just not calculating. And it's, I don't know if this is a question for psychologists, for historians, but it is really mind-boggling. And what's concerning is that we are slipping into something that is not a functioning democracy anymore, where people are hating their government for taking whatever steps are needed to just keep them alive and allow them to go back to work.
Well, you know, as a conservative, one of the things that, again, I'm promoting the Bulwark. We have a piece by Richard North Patterson in as well, talking about, look, you know, you guys on the right, you've had this complicated relationship with science for some time, and it's one of those things that I'm reading and I'm sort of grinding my teeth and wincing, because we are reaping the whirlwind here of the long-term attack on expertise, the sneering at science, the willingness to accept these kind of conspiracy theories, alternative realities, and you know, and whether it is the you know, the creationists, or whether it is the anti-vaxxers, again, this seems like the old story, but they've always been sort of there, but they were on the fringes, and you could kind of roll your eyes and just sort of assume that they would never move to center stage. And in real time, we are watching the real cost of tolerating these ideas, the real cost of having an entire, you know, right-wing media ecosystem, you know, that is, you know, sneered at the notion of man-made climate change and all of that. And I mean, I think there's a legitimate debate that you can have about what policies you should have mm-hmm. about that. But what we're seeing is that there was this undertow of anti-scientism. And I know people on the left are going, well, you're just now realizing that. Well, what I'm now realizing is the degree to which the immune system of the Republican Party has been absolutely destroyed. I don't mean compromised. I mean, absolutely, utterly destroyed. I mean, how many Republicans are speaking up in favor of Anthony Fauci? I mean, Liz Cheney, give her a shout out. But basically, everybody's looking the other way. They're letting this happen.
Yeah, I read that piece as well by Richard North Patterson. Excellent, really thorough in terms of this sort of disavowing of facts and science. And I also listened to your podcast a while back with former Hardball anchor Chris Matthews, who I think offered a really interesting point of view on that, which is that somehow science and research and, you know, that sort of approach to problem solving is perceived as elitist. And people that follow or adhere to sort of the far right conservative doctrine under Trump, I don't really think it's Republicanism, but feel put down by that, somehow feel emasculated or lesser than. I thought it was a really interesting point of view. And I think the challenge for thoughtful people across the political spectrum is how do we reconnect that? How do we empower people to look at good decision-making sources and practices for themselves and not make it political anymore? I don't know. We need a leader somewhere that can have that kitchen table message that it's really okay to pay attention to facts and science and, you know, weigh both sides of the coin and take into account other people's point of view. That's all good stuff. And I frankly want, you know, our children to make decisions that way. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, as somebody who's been a part of this movement, I mean, I understand the mentality. I mean, I'm appalled by it, but I do understand it. So, and here's the parallel that one of the reasons why so many people on the right have rejected climate change science is because they think that it has been politicized, that it is a pretext for a massive expansion of government control and regulation of their lives. So what they're doing is they're conflating the science with the political agenda. So if you accept the science, then somehow you've also validated this left-wing, you know, Trojan horse to, you know, have the government come in. That there, for a lot of conservatives, a lot of people on the right, the climate science became kind of the new socialism, the new way to put the government in charge. Well, I'm seeing the same sort of attitude now with the pandemic, that if you accept the science of the pandemic, that is a the scientific warnings about the pandemic are pretext to expand government control over your life, so that it becomes kind of this populist pushback against the pandemic science in the same way that you had the pushback against the climate science. I should write this up, because these are the same sort of attitudes that you're seeing, where you've politicized it because you think the other side has politicized it. Do you follow me?
That yeah, basically, I know I do.
It's all George Soros has this plan for world domination. So he's cooked up a couple of things. He's cooked up this idea of climate change. He's cooked up this idea of the pandemic. And if we're going to fight for freedom in America, we have to push back against both, you know, those signs. Okay. So, okay.
But that's a fallacy. Can I just say?
Of course it is. Yes.
It's a fallacy in part because, you know, the boogeyman in terms of overbearing government power is Donald Trump in this moment. And I say that, you mentioned Trump versus Vance. His lawyers are making that argument before the United States Supreme Court, the argument they made before the United States Senate, that the president has unlimited power and no accountability. That regardless of, you know, if you change the office of the president, then, you know, the next Democrat that comes in that office has that level of power as well. That is really where the massive amount of potentially power that could infringe on individual liberties. That's what's happening. It's not in, I don't know who the government is. These like career public servants who are now such bad guys for actually investigating Russian interference in the election. I don't understand what that government means other than someone with the amount of power of Donald Trump in this moment.
Okay, so this is a great segue. Let's talk about this case because 2 days ago, we had this U.S. Supreme Court. Was it 2 days ago? I've lost track of time during this, Timmy.
It was Tuesday,
Tuesday. The U.S. Supreme Court heard the Trump versus Vance, which is ostensibly about whether or not the president should have to give up, you know, turn over his income tax forms to Congress. There's a lot of things going on here, so you correct me. Mm-hmm. And it does seem to become, it will become a major case, really answering the question, is the president above the law? What is the relationship between these co-equal branches of government? So talk to me about that, because that we don't want to have that get lost. I think your point is that may be the most consequential constitutional decision that the court makes this year.
Yeah, I really think it is in terms of the structure of government. Most people think about the Constitution involving rights, Second Amendment, First Amendment. But the structure, the three-branch structure where every branch gets their papers graded by the other two branches, I mean, that's really foundational to being able to have individual rights. And remember, the last two presidents that went up to the United States Supreme Court, Nixon and Clinton, basically saying, we don't want to give you information. Investigators, both of them unanimously lost. So Clinton, he said, listen, there's a sexual harassment case by a staffer from years ago. She wants me to sit for a deposition. I'm president right now. I'm really busy. It's a civil mm-hmm. case. She wants money for herself. Can't she just wait until I'm done being president? I've got big stuff to do. Supreme Court said, no, you can be pulled off of that for a civil deposition. Nixon, of course, said, I'm not going to turn over the tapes of recordings from the Oval Office. And the United States Supreme Court said, even over executive privilege, your recordings in your office as president are not protected from a federal trial subpoena in the criminal context. Here we don't have anything relating to Trump as president, period, right? We're talking about his accounting records and his bank records and the records of the Trump Organization and his children from when he was a private citizen. And the records aren't being held by the president or his family. They're held by these third parties. So Congress on the one hand, and then Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan DA on the other, subpoenaed Mazars, his accounting firm, as well as two banks, and said, turn over these documents because the Manhattan DA wanted them in connection with a criminal investigation. And Congress wanted it for all kinds of stuff relating to what's going on with Trump. I can get into that. And essentially, they said, you know, Trump's telling us not to turn it over. So what we have here, and this was admitted really in open court by the government's lawyers, is a moment where the Supreme Court could potentially step in and effectively reverse Nixon and Clinton, or at least a conservative Supreme Court, and said, you know what, and say something like, listen, the president is above the law, period, when he's in the office of the presidency. Congress can't step on the president's toes without some limiting principle. So I think we could see the court say, listen, Congress, you need to prove why you need stuff from the president's past. And with respect to Mr. Vance, I think the argument would be, listen, having to make sure that your banks and your accountants don't turn over stuff you don't like, that's too cumbersome for president. And the progressive justices were like, wait a minute, why is it not too cumbersome to sit for a civil deposition in a sex harassment suit, but it'd be too cumbersome for this? And they also said, you know, you're worried about Congress abusing the subpoena power, but we haven't seen thousands and thousands of civil lawsuits against sitting presidents either. So we're not only at a moment where we could see basically an unaccountable president see in terms of oversight, virtually unaccountable. We have the Supreme Court poised to essentially start mandating limits on the legislature. So it's also going to be a lot of power for the Supreme Court of the United States, which is, to me, also seems contrary to conservative principles. They should really stay out of this stuff to the extent to which they can. And they don't need to step in this moment. They really don't.
So what does your gut tell you about this? Now, I know there are some legal analysts were early on predicting that Trump would lose this and lose this unanimously, that the court has an institutional interest. The Nixon case was decided unanimously. Clinton case was decided unanimously. There's a lot of reasons why it would be great to have a unanimous decision. And as you point out, the precedents seem pretty clear here. So what is your gut sense about what's breaking down? Will this break down into another 5-4 decision?
I really do think so. I mean, all the lower courts applied Nixon and Clinton and said, listen, this is so far afield. Those presidents had to turn over stuff. It led to Nixon's resignation. It led to Clinton's impeachment. This was dangerous stuff for them to turn over. They did it. And that wasn't unconstitutional. But I think if there is a conservative majority, we'll have to see what happens with Justice Roberts. They're going to want to put limits both on Congress, I think, and on state prosecutors. There's also a federalism issue here, right? This is a state prosecutor. They're going to want to essentially put barriers up to say, you have to show something to the courts. You have to prove Congress, or you have to prove state prosecutors that you really need this stuff. And they're going to make up some tests that no law don't exist right now in the law under these circumstances. The conservatives on the court could make up new standards that would bind Congress trying to get this information for purposes of legislating, or bind state prosecutors, grand juries trying to get this information for purposes of criminal
But that would feel it feels like then they would sort of carve out a special immunity for Donald Trump that no other previous president enjoyed.
Right. But of course, this is a mantle that will be passed on to future presidents. So, I mean, if you're like Donald Trump, but you don't like AOC, or you don't like, you know, the Joe Biden, the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court makes a constitutional decision like this, it's set in stone. It's almost like amending the Constitution itself. There's nothing in Article 2 of the Constitution which gives the president his powers that says anything about immunity, that says anything about executive privilege, that says anything about limiting Congress's power vis-a-vis oversight of the presidency. There is immunity for members of Congress to some degree. There are limits on the president's ability to pardon criminal convictions from states. So the framers didn't put these limits on investigating the president in the Constitution itself. But when the Supreme Court comes down, as you indicate, in favor of this particular president, this is a train that's going to run for all future presidents. And that's why constitutional scholars like myself are really, really concerned about it. I mean, it really reshapes the separation of powers. It creates a mega branch, the presidency, and two baby branches, essentially, legislature being the littlest baby.
So you know that I'm not prone to irrational optimism. Right. I mean, you know that. But I have a hard time imagining conservative justices. There's so many reasons why conservatives should not really protect Donald Trump here. Number one is, of course, the overturning of precedent, the institutional damage that it would do. And also because of the things you pointed out, that you're talking about documents that have nothing to do with the actual presidency. They're in third party hands. Seems to be so many ways in which they could rule in a way that would be consistent with their record, that it would be such a dramatic and radical departure that something inside me tells me that the real judicial conservatives on that court, leaving aside the ideologues like, say, Clarence Thomas, just would have a really hard time doing that.
Well, I think Justice Alito is probably of all of the justices, the one that was most concerned about President Trump in the, you know, and I did work with Brett Kavanaugh many years ago. And he's a separation of powers expert. He taught at Harvard for a long time. We've had discussions around these issues. I agree with you. I think he's a hawk on protecting the prerogative of the three branches. And there is an easy way out, right? The easy way out here is that judges just decide whether the subpoena is burdensome. So listen, Charlie, if you get a subpoena, if the Bulwark gets a subpoena, you go to court, you move to quash it or stop the subpoena, and you argue and you say, listen, this is overly broad, or this is too difficult for me to comply with. And the president can do that too, just like everybody else, and say, this is hard for me because instead of tweeting or golfing or whatever he's doing, I now have to talk to my bank about whether there's certain records that they should withhold because there's some other kind of basis for withholding them. He could just make that argument like the rest of the world does, and he doesn't need some special carve out. Judges know how to balance that stuff.
That seems extremely reasonable, and that seems that check is built into the system. So wouldn't that be another reason for the judges to say, okay, that's not a worst case scenario for the judges to say that. In order to subpoena the president, you just have to make a case for why it is not burdensome, why you need it, right?
I think it would be the other way around. And this is part of what it came down to, is the burden of proof. So Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan made this argument. Listen, we have a process in place. And this is certainly a lot less burdensome than what Clinton had to go through. It's a lot less burdensome with what Nixon had to go through. We're not even talking about documents in the White House. These are private. Yeah. But I think what it came down to is who has the burden. So does the Congress and a state prosecutor have to make a showing before they serve the subpoena? Or is it up to Trump, like the rest of us, to go to court and say, here's my subpoena, judge, stop the subpoena? Who has the burden? Mm-hmm. Do you have a is there a prerequisite to serving a subpoena? That would be new. And that is something I don't think is in the law, and that potentially there are some conservative justices that would vote for that.
What do you think of Jay Sekulow's arguments before the court? It struck me that he was making claims that had to have the justices rolling their eyes.
Yeah, he was very forceful in his presentation, which is unusual for advocates at the Supreme Court level. It sounded a lot like his closing arguments in impeachment, and his argument was very circular. And it was essentially like Article II power means Article II power. The president is the boss, And, you know, Justice Kavanaugh and others pressed a number of the lawyers on what is the Article II power here? What is the power? Where in Article II does it say that the president doesn't have to turn over, and his family and his private businesses don't have to turn over any information to anyone once the president is in office? And essentially, this gets back to the famous OLC memo saying you can't prosecute a sitting president. That's not in the Constitution. That's not in a United States Supreme Court decision. It's not in a statute. It's not in a regulation. The theory, again, is it's just too much of a pain for the president to do all his jobs that he does under Article II and have to deal with this kind of nuisance lawsuits, even if the nuisance lawsuit is an investigation by a state prosecutor. And the progressive, you know, the justices in the court said, but what about a sexual harassment lawsuit for money damages in the civil court? I just don't know how, to your point, the conservatives on the court can do this and not take a chunk out of Clinton versus Jones.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, and you mentioned this earlier, in effect, you'd have to overturn some of that. And there hasn't been a lot of pressure to do that, has there? I mean, I know these things happen very, very quickly. Recall Kavanaugh saying something that was interpreted as suggesting that maybe the Nixon case was decided wrongly. But when's the last time the court overturned a unanimous decision?
Well, I mean, this conservative court's been, you know, more aggressive actually in overturning established precedent than I think people would assume, given that the conservative, I think, mantra is to sort of leave well enough alone. But true, I mean, I think the government's position here was, when asked, what do you do about Clinton versus Jones? What do you do about Nunes versus Nixon? The response was, well, those are recent precedents. We need to go way, way back to the founding. And of course, I don't know about you, 1974, I think it was in that. That's not so recent. So they did kind of quietly make that argument. But, you know, these are smart people. They know how to write an opinion and overrule something without expressly overruling something. They could figure out a way around it without just kind of saying forthright, we're reversing ourselves. But it is an absolutely vital, vital, vital decision, because it means, listen, we know impeachment doesn't work in our modern age for a lot of reasons that we've talked about. Maybe it worked for Nixon, but it doesn't work anymore because the Senate majority is not going to ever remove someone from their own party right now. And for other reasons, because of the OLC memos, you can't federally prosecute a president or investigate a president. So what's left is congressional oversight, federalism, state oversight. So if you take those two out, then all we really have left for oversight of a president is the election. And I know you and I have talked a lot about our concerns about the election. If that is bogus, if that's kind of the Russians are interfering, we know that happened and Mueller said it's happening for November 2020. I don't know what the government's doing when they're running around saying 2016 wasn't a problem. I don't know what they're doing about 2020. So we're left with, what are we left with? With Charlie, what is our government anymore?
Yeah. Speaking of,
I mean, what's the accountability lever?
Well, exactly. I mean, it really is. It is the election, because there is nothing else. I mean, that is that seems to be the reality. And well, of course, we'll find out whether or not the courts are going to be this kind of a check. Speaking of the courts, you saw this morning, federal appeals court this morning revived the lawsuit seeking to block Trump's hotel and downtown Washington from accepting payments from foreign and state governments. This is a divided decision. Court refused to dismiss the lawsuit that accuses the president of illegally profiting from foreign and state government patrons at the Trump Hotel in D.C., the case brought by Maryland, the District of Columbia, one of a set of lawsuits alleging the president's private business transactions violate the Emoluments Clause. Kind of interesting that that at least that's still moving ahead. So at least the checks on the government, I mean on the president, they're not all dormant. There's stuff happening. Right.
And those series of emoluments lawsuits, I'm getting kind of wonky here, but a lot of what's happening in these lawsuits is around something called standing. Or we've heard the political question doctrine that came up with respect to political gerrymandering. It's why the Supreme Court wouldn't touch that. So there's this kind of threshold way courts can say, I'm out, even if they don't address the merits or, you know, the real issues. And one of them is saying, you know what, this plaintiff isn't really hurt by this. This is too tangential. Come back to me tomorrow. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz, you know, closes the door on Dorothy and says, come back to me tomorrow, another day. And with these emoluments lawsuits, it's been hard to find someone that satisfies that threshold injury requirement, that standing requirement. And it looks like the Fourth Circuit reversed the lower courts and said, you know, these plaintiffs do get to go to the next stage of litigation. So it's not good news for the Trump administration, but it is good news for, I think, an accountable government and the Constitution itself, frankly.
So we'll be getting the ruling in Trump versus Vance in when? June?
Yeah, I think that's about, sometime over the summer.
That's before the election.
I mean, as far as the election, of course, if the answer is that they uphold the lower courts, then we're going to see Congress have access to some of these financial records that I think the world has been interested in seeing for a long time. Remember, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, in the oral argument, the reason we're in this mess right now with Trump versus Vance is because this president hasn't cooperated with the other branches. I mean, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, was in a colloquy around Whitewater. This similar type of subpoena was issued to President Clinton from Congress during Whitewater. He complied. He didn't challenge it. And so, you know, this president hasn't turned over his tax returns. He just has said, no, no, no. It's kind of your point earlier. And so it could really be a moment where we're going to the narrative will shift towards more facts that have been kept under wraps. And I think you're right. This is not just a question for the presidency, but it's a question for the legitimacy of the United States Supreme Court itself. And I'm sure Justice Roberts understands that. The Chief Justice understands that. And others, conservative justices, understand the stakes here.
One would hope so. Kim Whaley, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this morning. As always, we really appreciate it.
Always, always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.